So, to get things started, my name is Deja Hergenlock from the Science Media Center. I'd like to welcome all of you to this briefing on mobile phone radiation and cancer risk. This briefing is following on from a very large study that has been conducted internationally. Starting in the late 1990s, there was some substantial reviews of the literature to see what risks were associated with use of mobile phone and whether there's any cancer risk associated with that. That was the time in which this study was kicked off. It's been a massive undertaking. 13 countries with research teams who've contributed to it. We're fortunate enough to have two of the contributors from New Zealand joining us today. Our first speaker will be Professor Alistair Woodward, who's head of the School of Population Health at University of Auckland. He, prior to that, was Professor of Public Health at the University of Otago in Wellington. He graduated from the University of Adelaide and has worked as an epidemiologist in Australia, Britain, and New Zealand, and he has interests in environmental health and tobacco control. He is one of the co-authors. Our second speaker will be Dr. David Black, who is a medical specialist based in Auckland. He is currently an honorary senior lecturer in environmental medicine at the University of Auckland, and he specializes in electromagnetic safety. He's a vocationally registered medical specialist and member of many associations, including the Australasian Radiation Protection Society. He was recently awarded the degree of Doctor of Medicine for his work specifically in the area of setting standards for mobile phone systems, and he's currently a consulting member of the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. Our third speaker will be Professor Neil Pierce, who is director of the Center for Public Health Research at Massey University. Professor Neil Pierce has conducted a wide range of public health research as part of his work at the Center for Public Health Research there at Massey. A wide range of areas including respiratory disease, cancer, diabetes, Maori health, Pacific health, and occupational and environmental health research. He has extensive research experience and he's with a particular emphasis on epidemiological methods. He's also a contributor to the New Zealand portion of Interphone. So I will now hand over to our first speaker, and I'll be muting the participants until the end of the conference to enable us to all clearly hear what the speakers have to say. Alistair, over to you.
Thanks very much. Welcome to everybody. I'm just trying to turn my cell phone off. I thought that I'd quickly run through the background to the study. It's been a large undertaking, and it may be helpful for people to understand why the study was set up and how it's proceeded. Am I audible? Can everybody hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Yep,
okay. Well, the reason, as Deja said, the study got underway was we were well aware in the 1990s that there had been this extraordinary spread of the use of mobile phones that had appeared in the early 1980s and become extraordinarily popular. And what they meant were that for the first time, really, people were taking a radio transmitter and holding it up very close to the side of their head. This was a category of radiation that we knew very little about, really, in terms of what the health effects might be. Well known, of course, that radiation of this kind has a heating effect. David perhaps can talk a bit more about this. But we weren't certain and remain uncertain about whether radiofrequency radiation has other biological effects. But given the introduction of the technology, its very widespread use, and our uncertainty about whether there were health effects, we thought that it was an important topic and one that we should look closely at. So that was the genesis of the Interphone study. The International Agency for Research on Cancer in the late 90s called together people who were interested in this topic. We looked at whether we thought it was going to be feasible to carry out a study of this kind, decided it was, and we knew that if we were going to make a contribution in this field, we needed a project which would use a common protocol, the same approach, in a large number of studies so that we could accumulate a large number of cases and obtain findings that would be as precise and accurate as possible. So as you can see on the slide, there were 13 countries that took part. New Zealand was one of the 13, and the people here in New Zealand who were leading the study were Angus Cook, who's now in University of Western Australia, Neil and myself. It took about 4 years overall for the data to be collected, and then over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been looking at the data, trying to analyze it, make sense of it, write up the methods, and also many of the individual study centers have reported the findings from their country. And then tomorrow morning in France, the full results are going to be released, papers coming out in the International Journal of Epidemiology. So it's been quite a journey to get to this point. The study design, hopefully I can make this plain, it's what's called a case control study, and what that means is that we took people who have newly diagnosed cases of brain tumours. The two major tumours are glioma, which are tumours of the brain itself, and meningiomas, which are tumours of the layer around the meninges, the membranes around the brain. Now, we restricted them in age to those aged 30 to 59, and the reason for that was at the time the study was launched, which you remember was the late 90s, cell phones, and we were looking back in time at cell phone use prior to that, this was the age group which were the early adopters of the technology. It was pretty expensive. A lot of it early on was associated with people's jobs. So we wanted to maximize our chance of finding an effect if there was one by restricting the study to the group in the population that was most likely to have used cell phones at a critical period. The comparison group was people of the same age taken from the general population, usually chosen from electoral rolls, to give us some kind of a reference. And the hypothesis, the study hypothesis, was that past use of mobile phones would be the same for both, that's a misprint there, both for people with the disease and people without. Now, an important point about this project is that we looked at alternatives, but really the only way we could get information about mobile phone use in the past was individual self-report. In other words, people were asked, have you ever used a cell phone? If you have, when did you start to use it? How much did you use it? And so on. So it wasn't possible for the great majority of participants in the study to get independent information, to get information from other sources about past use of mobile phones. Well, what did we find? Well, the first thing is when we simply compared those who'd been regular users of mobile phones in the past with those who had not been regular users of mobile phones, we had this rather surprising result that, in fact, people who reported using mobile phones were less likely to have suffered from these particular brain tumours, glioma or meningioma. And that was about a 20% reduction in risk that couldn't be explained by chance. Whatever the explanation was, it wasn't just that it was a fluke. So that was not what we had expected to find. If there was absolutely no association between mobile phone use and the risk of these tumours, you would get an odds ratio or a relative risk of 1. And the fact that the figure is below 1 means that what we're looking at is reduced risk amongst those who used phones. We were able to get information from people who had used phones for a long period, more than 10 years, It's one of the strengths, I think, of Interphone, is that it's the first project, really, that gives us some information about long-term use. And in this group, there was no difference in the risk of disease between those who were regular users and those who were non-users. The other important point to make is that, as I said, there were 13 countries involved. And if you looked at the individual country results, it was pretty much the same pattern across all the study centres. Now, we also looked at the amount used. So it wasn't just a case of comparing regular users and people who weren't regular users. Obviously, we were interested to look at the amount people had used cell phones in the past. That included both the number of calls that people had made and their estimated duration of call time, the amount of time they'd spent on cell phones. And in this slide here, you can see that the results are shown for usage groups ranging all the way from the lowest 10% of users in terms of call time to the highest 10% of users in terms of call time. And as I mentioned, a figure of 1 means no difference. A result of less than 1 means that usage is actually protective, and a figure of greater than 1 is an increased risk amongst those who use the cell phone. And you can see that for 9 out of the 10 exposure groups, there's no association or an apparent protective effect, and it's in the heaviest 10% of users that you see this increase in risk. And again, that's not due to chance, not a fluke, but what might explain it? Important to note here that there's no appearance of a dose response effect. In other words, we'd normally expect to see, if there was a true effect, that the risk would gradually increase with increasing exposure, but that's not apparent here. And also, I've shown you the results for call time, but if we do the same analysis for number of calls, then we don't see this pattern. There's no evidence of an increased risk in the highest exposure category. Well, how to explain these findings? The paper that's being released tomorrow has a great deal of discussion about this, where we present the results and then try to explain what it is that we've come across. These are the major possible explanations, I believe, for the apparent reduction in risk that we've observed for most of cell phone users. Firstly, this study obviously involved on depended on people agreeing to take part in the study, and in our reference group, of those people who were eligible to take part, only half agreed to take part and participated. It's not uncommon in population studies of this kind, but what it does mean is that it raises the possibility that those who take part in the study are different in important respects from those who could have taken part but didn't. And we know that, in fact, it's true that mobile phone users were more likely to take part in the study. In other words, we were oversampling from the population at large. So we know that that's the case, and that this could well contribute to our result, although it seems unlikely to explain it entirely. There are some other possibilities. One is that tumours may be silent, not apparent, not diagnosed, but nevertheless affect people's behaviour. We don't think that that's likely to be an explanation in this case. Is there something else that goes along with being a cell phone user that affects the risk of disease, that is protective in some way? That's a possibility, but we can't think of anything that we could definitely identify there. And then the last possibility is that there is a real protective effect. Now, that seems implausible because we can't think of any biological reason why that should be the case. But it has to be still, I believe, listed as a possibility, although an extraordinarily unlikely one. Well, what about the increase in risk for the most for the heaviest users? What might explain that? Well, again, we can think of some reasons why that might arise from systematic errors in the study. That it might be the case that since we were relying on self-reporting of phone use in the past, that there's over-reporting by cases compared to controls, and that people who are very heavy users tend to systematically overestimate their amount of use compared with people who are more moderate users. Now, we've got some evidence to suggest that both these factors have applied, but again, on their own, they don't seem sufficient to fully explain the results that we see. And, of course, the third option is that there is a real increase in risk. But if it is real, it's small and it applies only to a small percentage of cell phone users. So I've raced through the study and very happy to take questions subsequently if people want to go back over anything that I've talked about. But in the final slide, I've just attempted to sum up what seems to me to be the major points. That this study is the largest conducted so far. It's been very carefully undertaken. It collects, it's involved researchers from all around the world. So I think it's, for all its imperfections, it's the sort of the best that we could do at this point in time. The findings actually are consistent with much of the research that's been previously reported, so I don't think it's entirely out of step. It's come up with a slightly unexpected finding of a reduced risk in most categories of phone use and an increase of risk in the category of highest use. Now, I've said here these patterns can't be fully explained. I believe that's the case. That they may result from systematic errors in the information obtained in the study, and maybe artifactual explanations. I'm sure that they have contributed, but whether they are the full story, just don't know. What's the bottom line? Well, I'm offering this as a bottom line, that overall, we're not seeing any increase in risk with mobile phone use in this study. Even amongst those, I've already said, even amongst those who've used their phones for 10 years or more, and I believe this is probably the important contribution of Interphone, that it's the first time we've got a substantial amount of information on people who've got long-term use of cell phones, and it's information from that's been obtained internationally from around the world. So I think I'll stop there. As I said, very happy to revisit any of those points if people have got questions or to explore new areas.
Great. Thank you very much, Alistair. We'll hold questions to the end of the presentations. I'd just like to say quickly, there looks like there may be one or two of you who are having trouble logging into the web conference still. The slides from our presenters are all available for download in the SMC Resource Library if you are already registered for that, so go ahead and download them there. Otherwise, we can sort something out after the briefing if you get in touch. Our next speaker is Dr. David Black. I'll hand over to you.
Yeah, thanks very much, and good afternoon. It's a privilege to be asked to contribute to the session. And I'll go straight to my first slide. And I just want to clarify that I think it's very important for everybody who is taking part this afternoon to realise that we are talking here about ultra-high frequency radio waves. Radio frequency being a part of the electromagnetic spectrum well below the frequency of visible light and well below the area where we have concerns about the classical effects of radiation such as X-rays and gamma rays and even, for that matter, ultraviolet. This is radio frequency below the frequency of sunlight with characteristics and biological effects which are well understood and generally limited to causing some tissue heating. Now, that, of course, does not exclude the possibility that there are some effects that we don't yet understand, but there are robust standards in place and have been for a long time for protecting against all of the known effects, and the ICNIRP, as it's known, the International Commission on Non-Ionising Radiation Protection, has published guidelines. That's an organisation which is associated with the World Health Organisation and the United Nations, and which New Zealand follows. And the important figures, I have a misprint too in my slides as well. I'm sorry, that that second category there where it says B field is wrong. That should in fact be occupational levels. It's all been done in rather a hurry, I'm sorry. So that slide needs correcting. But the two numbers there, the 2 watts per kilogram is the specific absorption rate for the average public user, and 10 watts per kilogram is the permitted level of exposure, which applies to occupational users. And that really only applies to occupational in the sense of radio frequency workers. It does not apply to people using cell phones in the course of their work. But the important thing to say about these guideline levels is that they do, as far as we know, protect against all established effects, and those levels are identified identical to those in the New Zealand standard, which is also in force at the moment in this country. So we have an internationally consistent approach in New Zealand with pretty well everywhere in the world. I'm just waiting for the next slide to come up there. It seems a little slow. Here we go. And so when we're talking about mobile phones, and we've been talking a bit about business users, so there's the one of the common business phones there on the right. What we're talking about is small radio transmitters, which are up to a quarter of a watt. Typically, they're getting lower than that, to more like a tenth of a watt. Maximum power, down-regulated, so that they only transmit the power that they need to transmit in order to maintain and to establish and maintain the connection. And typically these days we're finding that phones of the second generation, that's the GSM system, which is widely used in New Zealand, are running between 10 and 50 milliwatts, which is half of a tenth of a watt, and the new systems, which are the third generation systems, are quite a bit lower than that. And they're well under those SAR limits of ICNIRP and IEEE, which I've mentioned before in the standards. And of course the length of use too is limited for many people by the cost. So to some extent mobile phones are only used when they have some benefit. Many people will limit their call lengths because it still does cost quite a bit to use them. Okay, so going on now to the next slide, and we have the findings, as Alistair said, is generally no effect apart from that rather surprising, perhaps protective effect, if it is one, or that is the finding of it. But there is still this possibility in these heavy users of an excess, as has been mentioned. Now, this is a surprising finding in the sense that if we are going to suggest the possibility that mobile phone use of any duration causes cancer, there is no established mechanism by which this can happen. And it would not be expected from what we know about the way in which radio frequency interacts with human tissues. And, of course, it might not be a causal relationship, as Alistair has said, and we'll hear more from Neil, I'm sure. There's other explanations as to why that finding could be. But what I want to say, and I'm very much coming here not as an epidemiologist, which I'm not, but as a clinician, I'm a physician, if radio frequency might cause cancer, and particularly if it does cause cancer, it actually does change everything, because all of the standards and all of the basis on which we have undertaken protection today is really on the assumption that radio frequency does not cause cancer. So if it does, even if it does only a little bit, Alistair mentioned the point that this effect is only in a small number of users, and that is so, but even so, if radio frequency can cause cancer, that, in my view, changes everything, because what we know so far leads us to the belief that it can't. So what are our options on these findings? And I mean, in the relatively short time available, I've just really, my initial thinking is that we have really, to me, three options. One of them is to just carry on as we are and call for more research. And I think calling for more research is obviously called for. It's obviously necessary and it's going to happen. In fact, further research is underway now. Another option, which may perhaps seem a little scary in a way, but I think is one that needs to be considered, is to actually look at the worst case that might have been scoped out by this and say, well, let's just think about what if it's true, you know, what then would be the potential impact on public health? And then say, well, is this risk acceptable? And we've actually done that in other areas. One of the areas that's associated where that has been done is with electric power. It's a different mechanism, almost for certain, but for reasons that are not at all understood, there are persistent findings of an association between the electricity that we use, alternating current and magnetic fields from it, and childhood leukemia. And one of the things that we certainly have done with that is to say, if this were true, what would be the impact on public health? And what we find is that it's very little. In a country the size of New Zealand, it's almost nil. And we certainly do take some precautions with the way we build power lines these days. But in terms of the way in which we use power in our homes, we really don't make any changes as a result of that possibility. So that's actually not a bad way to deal with data like this. And in fact, it's probably the way in which I would favour. Another approach, and this is one that's going to be suggested a lot, is to call for further research. I think everybody's agreeing on that. But also to adopt a precautionary approach in the meantime. Now, I have some real reservations about that approach, because the question is what are we going to do that? Are we going to limit our precaution to mobile phones? Are we going to limit exposure? And what is the exposure? I mean, what is it that matters about the exposure? Is it the peak level or is it the duration? We're not really sure. We may, in fact, get some guidance from the epidemiologists to analyse the study about that latter point. But if we're actually going to do something, it needs to be an honest attempt, which might well make a difference. In other words, an intervention in public health needs to be something which will actually have a reasonable chance of improving public health or providing some protection. And unless it is, it's not really, to me, a very honest approach. So if we go around, for example, encouraging the use of devices to limit exposure or changing the levels of mobile phones, there's got to be a reasonable chance that it will do something. And now, Alistair has mentioned that there's no real dose-response relationship, and whilst there is not, I do put a question mark on that in the sense that there is a possibility of dose response, not in the way of seeing a gradual increase of response with dose, which is what we normally would expect, but there is, what we do have here is an effect at possibly high or long exposure levels, and not the same effect at lower levels. And That is in many ways the most difficult outcome you can end up with, because you then have the problem, what do we mean by a high dose? Is it high levels? Is it long exposure? Is the working model dose times time? In other words, do we take the amount that you're exposed to, is so many minutes on a phone, and how many times you do it during the day or during the week? In other words, how do we work it out? And particularly in this case, when we see an effect for one group but not with others, we have to ask the question, is there a threshold, or is there a point below which this doesn't happen, and then a level above which it does happen? That would be a very important point if it were true. But again, if that's true, we've still got a real problem. There's something happening here which previously we have assumed it doesn't happen at all. And of course, if we're going to take precautions, we would have to assume the worst case. And the worst case really is that there is an effect from radio frequency exposure, if it's true. And of course, that is not just mobile phones, it's radio frequency exposure. And some of the work which I've done, and it's very limited work in looking, is the fact that the radio frequency exposure for most people in New Zealand, in my opinion, and it is only an opinion and it's not a result of published work is yet, but is that we probably are getting more radio frequency exposure from cordless phones, which we use in our house. Now, they're quite small. They're only 10 milliwatts, but we tend to use them for long periods, hours at a time. And so perhaps these are becoming a more significant source of RF exposure for most people, particularly in the home and particularly children, than mobile phones. So we need to look at that very carefully if we're going to start talking about precaution. And one of the reasons why I think this is really important is this graph results from a very limited study which I have done, in which if we look at these levels here, and I'll just turn the circle on here, look at these levels here. These are the levels from mobile phones of the new third generation. And if we look at the level of the modern digital cordless phones, that's the constant level that we have there. So although the full power of these third generation phones is up there, it's virtually never reached. And so the levels from cordless phones are higher than mobile phones. So we need to be very clear, if we're going to start talking about precautions about radio frequency exposure, we need to be clear where that exposure is coming from. So it's not quite as simple as just giving some advice about mobile phone use. So in conclusion, the point that I'm leading to is that any ideas about precaution need to be honest and plausibly beneficial. We must give accurate information to the public and consumers. You know, unfortunately, the history of medicine is littered with public health advice which turns out to be wrong or changed or only partially right. And, of course, the public is very, very cynical about this. I mean, I find, in talking to people about this, people quote to me all the time things that medicine has said and then turned out to be wrong or changed. The Interphone study doesn't establish causality, and I think that's been made clear by Alistair already. It simply gives us some useful information on which to carry on. I think that no intervention other than further research is justified, and as I've already said, I think it must at least look at, in the first instance, all RF exposure, not just mobile phones. So that's the end of my presentation. I'll be happy to answer questions at the appropriate time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. We'll move on to our third speaker, Neil Pierce. A number of you seem to have dialed in as well. If you'd like to log in on the web conference, you'll be able to see the slides also. We'll save questions to the end. Go ahead, Neil. Excuse me, Neil.
Much time, because I'm mostly just going to add a few comments to what Alistair and David have already said. This study was headed in New Zealand by Alistair, who was the first presenter, and I was a co-investigator and provided some advice to the study and to the interpretation. So I'll just give a few slides talking about the interpretation now, particularly to follow on from Alistair's comments. And I'm just going to ask four questions. Firstly, does the study show that cell phones protect against brain tumours? As Alistair has mentioned, to our surprise, the people who've got brain tumours, actually a slightly lower percentage of them have used cell phones than the general population controls, who were healthy people without brain tumours. I think probably not. There's a misprint there, but it should say there's no known mechanism by which cell phone use would protect against brain tumours, and it's implausible biologically. Although certainly you can't rule out the possibility, but it seems quite unlikely. Also, if they did protect against brain tumours, then the more people used cell phones, the lower the risk of brain tumours we would expect to see, but we don't see that. There's no dose response. And thirdly, as Alistair has already mentioned, it's probably more likely that people who use a cell phone were more likely to agree to participate in the study than people who don't, and that this effect was stronger for the healthy general population controls for the cases with brain tumours. And you see the response rate was about 71% of the cases and 53% of the controls, and there is some evidence that people who use cell phones were more likely to participate, which is not surprising. If you get asked to participate in a study about cell phones, you're more likely to participate if you use one. So there's a weak protective effect, but it's unlikely to be real, and it's more likely that it's due to this sort of bias that people were more likely to participate if they used a cell phone. Or just that people who don't use a cell phone at all can be a little different from the rest of the general population. So that's the first question. The second question, does the study show that cell phones increase the risk of brain tumours? I think probably not, because the study generally shows no evidence of an increased risk in cell phone users. And I would say that if a large risk existed, then this study would have found it. It's the biggest and best study that's been done. It has relatively long follow-up. It's done by the WHO, International Agency for Research on Cancer, with some of the top researchers in the world. And if there was some major increased risk going on, then it would have found it. But, and there's a series of buts here, we can't rule out that there's some small risk that we're having trouble detecting. Secondly, there is some, not very conclusive evidence of an increased risk in long-term, well, in heavy users, essentially. Thirdly, cell phones have not been used very long. I think the longest use in this study was about 11 years, and most cancers actually take 15 to 30 years to develop. Brain tumours, perhaps a little less, but still 11 years of use would be really the minimum period of time that you would start to see an increased risk appearing. So the study was worth doing, and it goes back just far enough, but only just. And fourthly, it's often argued that it's biologically implausible that cell phones could cause brain tumours or other cancers, but this may just be because the relevant laboratory studies haven't been done yet. There's about 40 known occupational and environmental causes of cancer recognised by the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer. And they were all discovered in studies of this type, and for almost all of them, when they were first discovered, people thought it was implausible because they used some sort of new mechanism that hadn't been thought of before. So what I'm saying in this slide is generally that this study's very reassuring, and that if there was an increased risk of brain tumours in cell phone users, then it would have found it. But there are a few qualifications to that, and it's still possible that in the future that an increased risk may become apparent. Fourth slide. Why are the findings not conclusive? Like I said, this is the biggest and best study in the world that's been done of this issue. And if there was a major risk, then the study would have found it. For example, smoking increases the risk of lung cancer by 10 times. If we were looking at that sort of effect, then we would have found it in the study. However, we can't rule out the possibility that there may be a small risk, particularly for long-term heavy users. And these types of studies are difficult to do. We're looking for a small increased risk over and above the normal risk of brain tumours in the general population. People have to agree to take part in the study, and we can't get a 100% response rate. In fact, it was about 71% in the cases and about 53% in the healthy controls. And this can affect the study findings. As Alice has mentioned, it's impossible to get completely accurate data on cell phone use, and essentially this was based on self-report. Researchers are very experienced at trying to assess these biases and to control or correct for them. And if you're looking at something that poses a substantial risk, then it's quite possible to live with these sorts of problems and to assess how strong the biases might be, to control or correct from them, for them, and to draw conclusions. But it's much harder when you're looking for a small increase in risk, as we're doing in this case. And finally, what should we do? The findings of the study are generally reassuring. If there had been a major increase in risk, the study would have found it. We can't rule out the possibility of a small risk or the possibility that larger risks may appear in the future, particularly for heavy users over the long term. What should we do? Don't panic. I think this study is generally very reassuring and indicates that regular use of cell phones doesn't increase the risk of brain tumours. I'm a researcher, so of course I'd recommend doing more research, but I think this study, the facts of the study indicate that it's reassuring, but there's a few blips there, and we should keep looking at this issue. And finally, in the meantime, take sensible precautions. The study indicates that regular cell phone use is very unlikely to increase the risk of brain tumours. There's a bit of a question mark over very heavy users, particularly people that are using their cell phones constantly for their work, and in that case, there's some obvious